Do not apply for this job if you can't handle minutiae, if you get bogged down by numbers, if you like to set easily achievable goals. Astronomy is not a career for the impatient, for the easily discouraged. If you're seeking fame or instant gratification, if you like concrete and easy verifiable answers, well, astronomy probably isn't for you. Save yourself the student loans, the years of postgraduate study. As an astronomer, you might dream of starry skies, but most of your days will be spent in an office, in front of a computer screen, developing research proposals, writing computer code, pouring through a seemingly endless stream of data, pleading for grants. If you do discover something new, a distant planet, filaments of star-forming gas, a dwarf star, it'll probably be a while before you can pop open the champagne. Months or years of trying to verify what you found. But if you persevere, if you're very determined and a little lucky, you might get to travel to a mountain in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You might get to watch a giant telescope in Hawaii spin in the night until it's focused on a patch of sky that you want to study. And if you're very, very lucky, there might be a day when you, or one of your colleagues, is sitting in front of a computer screen looking at real-time infrared images of a distant moon, and you see something that makes everything worth it.
We have an astronomer named Imka Dapata, and she spends twilight looking at Io, and she looks for volcanoes on Io.
This is Ann Kinney, the chief scientist at Keck, the largest observatory currently on Mauna Kea.
One morning, she's there observing, and a volcano starts going off, and of course she starts screaming. You're seeing something nobody has seen before.
And this thing that no one has seen before, it's not just a newly discovered volcano millions of miles from Earth. It's part of something much bigger, a transformation in our understanding of the universe.
20 years ago, the sky was seen to be very static. You know, to learn that the universe is constantly changing, that Io has constant volcanic eruptions, that supernova go off at huge distances on a constant basis, and our concepts have changed. The Earth has changed under our feet. And that's really much more exciting than just plain, you know, increasing the number of facts you have about the universe.
From Honolulu Civil Beat and PRX, this is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. This is episode 3 of our season, The Sacred Mountain. The story's chronological, so if you haven't heard the other episodes, go check them out first. In this season, we're taking a look at the fight over plans to build a giant telescope, the 30-meter telescope, on Mauna Kea, Hawaii's most sacred mountain. In the last episode, we visited the mountain with some of the native Hawaiians who were trying to block construction of the TMT. Today, we're going to focus on the scientists. Spend time with the people who work at the 13 telescopes on Mauna Kea today, and visit the people who want to build there tomorrow. For most astronomers in Hawaii, the 30-meter telescope is a thrilling prospect, an incredible tool that could solve some of the biggest mysteries about our universe. But protests over the telescope have also frightened many scientists, made them worry about the future of all astronomy in Hawaii. And it's revealed an enormous gap between the way astronomers perceive themselves and the way their work is perceived by others. What are the astronomers discovering on Mauna Kea? And why do they want the 30-meter telescope so badly? To get a better understanding of why Mauna Kea is so important to astronomy, I arranged to spend the day at the Keck Observatory, the biggest, and quite possibly the most badass observatory currently on the mountain. My tour guide for the day is Grant Hill, an astronomer who's also the operations manager at Keck.
Morning, Grant.
We meet at around 8 a.m. at Hale Pohaku, a collection of astronomy buildings just above the Mauna Kea Visitor Information Center at 9,000 feet. There are dormitories for visiting astronomers, a cafeteria, loungewear workers coming from Hilo can stop and acclimate to the high altitude before driving the rest of the way to the summit. We grab coffee and then hop in Grant's SUV for the rest of the drive up to the observatories. About 20 minutes on a bumpy, winding, mostly unpaved road. The drive is stunning. You can see Hawaii Island's other mountain, Mauna Loa, in the distance. There's snow along the side of the road that's frozen in strange little formations. And these large hills, or pu'u, that make up the summit.
Let me point out, see that pu'u there off in the distance?
Yes.
That's my, in some sense, that's my favorite pu'u.
Why?
Well, even at this time of day, you can see that the reds and the greens and the blacks, all the colors in it. But at sunset, holy moly, that thing is beautiful.
There's a reason Keck's an important place to visit. Pick any major astronomical discovery in the last 30 years, and odds are the Keck Observatory has played some part in it. Here's Keck's chief scientist, Ann Kinney, again.
So let me tell you a little bit about some of the very profound changes that have taken place in astronomy in the era of Keck. One, the very, very distant universe is much closer than it used to be. It used to be a complete mystery, as if we were in a cotton ball and we could only see a tiny little way into the cotton ball, and now we can see way, way far. We live in a much larger universe today than we used to. That's one way to put it. Another is a true difference in our concept of about how much the universe changes. We really thought of the universe as static. And by universe, I also mean solar system, that the solar system itself was static. Well, that all changed when we saw a great big asteroid hit into Jupiter and, you know, make pockmarks on its surface. So we live in a world now where we see changes practically on a daily basis in the solar system and the universe. So a changing universe instead of a static universe. And then the third major change, and this one is just huge, is that we did not used to know that there were planets around any other star but our own. And now the count, you know, exceeds 4,500 planets rotating around other stars. And so that really makes you wonder, those are the ones we can see. What about the ones we can't see? And by the way, you know, is there pond scum living on those planets, or perhaps bipeds or tripeds? Or all of those three fields Keck played a major, major role in.
The Keck Observatory is really two telescopes housed in two enormous 10-story white domes. The domes are off to the side, a bit away from what's been deemed the official summit of Mauna Kea. You can see another telescope nearby, and then the winding road that continues past Keck. Both of Keck's telescopes are about 10 meters, and it's the size of these telescopes that give them an advantage over a space-based telescope like Hubble, which is less than 3 meters across. If you're like me and you don't have a science background, if the difference between a telescope and an observatory confuses you, a little primer might be helpful here. A telescope, well, at least an optical telescope, is basically a giant mirror, a tool for collecting and focusing light. Keck's two telescopes are made up of dozens of individual mirrors that can be very precisely calibrated to collect light from distant stars and galaxies. Highly specialized instruments then process that light into images and data for astronomers. Here's Grant Hill again.
Most of what Keck does is what's called spectroscopy, where you take the light from some object, a star, a planet, a galaxy, and you split it up into like a rainbow, essentially, but in such detail that you can make very precise measurements of the amount of light you're getting from that object. That allows you to do physics. It allows you to do all kinds of things, like measure the velocity of the object through space. If it's a star, you can measure, say, how fast it's spinning. You can measure temperatures, pressures, chemical abundances.
These telescopes are doing things that astronomers 50 years ago could never have imagined. The discoveries keep coming, And nowhere in the world are they coming in as big and as fast as right here at the top of Mauna Kea.
Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We head into a staff meeting room in a low building in between the two domes. Giant snowdrifts block all but a few inches of the window.
Before we get started, Grant's going to introduce our guests and what they're doing here today.
About a dozen men gather in the room. Most wear overalls, heavy boots. Few wear portable oxygen tanks.
I think if you look at the logs since last Thursday, we've been averaging close to 8.5 on each telescope each night. So excellent work and really good science nights.
Building observatories and then maintaining them at 14,000 feet above sea level is hard. On human bodies, on machines. The astronomers, they call it summit brain. It's harder to think up here, harder to perform simple tasks. Even walking around is difficult for me and my producer, April. The air is thin. It takes 3 breaths to pull as much oxygen into your body as 1 breath in Hilo.
Yeah, just having a hard time catching my breath. Sorry, guys, can we pause for a minute? April's feeling lightheaded. Do you want to go sit down in the break room or do you need to go down?
I can continue to do it. Okay, I'll put her on the helios. And I'll need to stay with her for a while until you're feeling better, okay?
Do you want me to stay with you?
Or?
No, I'm okay.
I do
I'm okay.
Too.
Okay. You can do if you start feeling worse, send for me and we'll just go back down together, okay?
If I have to put her on real oxygen, you've got to get out of here.
Yeah, so just
but I think the helios will be fine.
Okay.
To compensate for summit brain, people at Keck do a lot of work in pairs, using many, many checklists. And they hold very careful meetings to plan out their work. The guys who helped April, they've got plenty of experience treating altitude sickness. There are some workers at Keck who wear the oxygen tanks all the time. But Ann Kinney says the tough working conditions are worth it.
We have the best seeing in the world. Now, seeing is one of my most favorite words because you probably think you know what it means, but you don't. When an astronomer says seeing, what it means is how clear is the sky. If you walk out at night and the stars are sparkling, that's not a good night. They're sparkling because the seeing isn't good. Imagine yourself lying at the bottom of a swimming pool, and if the surface of the swimming pool is really smooth, the seeing will be very good. If the surface of the swimming pool is filled with waves, you're not going to be able to see anything. And it's exactly that way with our atmosphere. There's a reason that we have a telescope on Keck, but we don't have one in the Rocky Mountains. The Rocky Mountains are turbulent. Mauna Kea is a volcanic cone, and it's smooth. And so that air flows up over the mountain and down the other side, and so your seeing is beautiful. It's the best seeing in the world.
It doesn't matter how good the seeing is at a location or how large the telescope. If an observatory doesn't have the right instruments for capturing the light from a telescope and processing it into really useful data. Each observatory designs their own instruments. Huge instruments, the size of a car, or maybe even a little hut. And the instruments are critical to an observatory's success. It's not unheard of for an observatory to spend a decade designing and building a new instrument. The search for planets capable of sustaining life?
Okay.
Keck's working on an instrument for that right now.
What's our gap, Steve? Is it like a quarter of an inch or an eighth of an inch?
Quarter?
Do me a favor, just measure it real quick.
Today at Keck, workers are painstakingly moving a new instrument into place, the Keck Cosmic Web Imager. The new instrument will produce an image in every single color, something that astronomers hope will allow them to get a better glimpse of light from very faint galaxies as they form.
It's a really exciting time for Luca, who has not gotten much sleep in quite a while, for everybody in the telescope, and it's going to be a big deal for the observatory.
Hey, David, be careful. Please don't step on the panel that the laser is on. Behind you.
We take an elevator to a metal platform about halfway up one of the Keck domes. The telescope is in the center of the dome.
Yeah.
The platform, by the way, is the only thing that doesn't move. The dome rotates. So does the giant telescope. Around the metal platform sit a series of different observatory instruments on little metal tracks, kind of like a miniature railway to slide instruments into or out of the telescope. Workers need to swap out the instruments during the day for whatever astronomer is using the telescope that night. It's one of the most important jobs at the observatory. Today they're working on astronomer Luca Rizzi's recently delivered Cosmic Web Imager, a more than 6-foot-tall black box that looks like a giant clunky box camera.
And how does it feel seeing your, this has been described as your baby, right? Your new instrument here?
Oh, this is my baby, yes. I've seen it grow, you know, and I spent many, many hours next to it.
Yeah, it's gonna hit.
One man lies down on the ground to measure the space between the platform and the telescope. They hit a roadblock, though.
Didn't work today, so we're probably going to have to move one of those yellow bolts.
You looked a little sad. Are you disappointed? Did you want to see it go all the way over?
It would have been easier if he could have gone all the way in. But again, this is exactly the reason why we have such a long schedule for installing these things and why we do these tests.
April catches back up with me inside the Keck Dome about 30 minutes later. She has little oxygen tubes in her nose and is wearing a small portable oxygen tank.
You're definitely okay?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. If not, we're doing okay recording.
She's doing
you can
great.
Sit and chill.
Okay. She got more attention than most people.
Okay.
Okay, it's a very male-dominated place up here, as you probably noticed. And not that we're very careful about undue attention, but if we have some due attention, okay. How many guys come in to help you? 2 or 3?
I think so. All right.
After the day crews leave, the observatory becomes a very different place. Each observatory on Mauna Kea is funded by a consortium of universities, countries, science institutions. In return for funding operations, each partner gets a certain number of nights on the telescope. Astronomers then compete heavily for time by submitting research proposals to the observatories or their funders. There's never enough time to go around. And if it's overcast or snowing on your night, tough luck. Try again next year. In previous decades, astronomers would come to the observatory on their assigned night. High-speed internet has changed that. Astronomers are still watching telescope observations in real time, just from a computer at an observatory's base facilities in Hilo or Waimea, or even from another state, another country.
I actually feel sorry for today's astronomers who observe down in these remote sites instead of going to the mountain. You know, it used to be you were right up there where the action was, and I don't think it's as much fun to be in a remote room looking at a bunch of computers. Early in my career, I did a lot of observing in a lot of sites, you know, in the Andes, in Australia, in Arizona, on Mauna Kea. And there has never been a time when I drove up to an observatory where I didn't just feel really excited. So it's a little bit like it's the beginning of running a marathon. You know, the shutter is going to open on the telescope and it's going to be dark out and it's your time. You have something that you are there to observe and you want to use every second of that time as precious to you. And then the night ends and you close the dome and it always makes you sad.
Each observatory has a large room full of computers where a telescope operator sits, usually alone, from dusk till dawn. They talk to astronomers on a video monitor, move the telescope so that it's directed onto the right point of sky for nightly observations. On the night that I'm there, by the time the dome's open for observing, the only people in the building are the two men operating the telescope and operations manager, Grant Hill.
Gary, Grant.
Go ahead.
Hey, just thought I'd let you know I'm making a pot of coffee down here.
Copy.
It's a whole different environment when it's at night up here.
Yeah. You know. I like it. I kind of like the quietness.
So dark, quiet, and
what I would suggest now mm-hmm. is we go back downstairs,
okay.
Go outside, and see the sunset.
All right. This is very cool, though.
We walk outside onto a flat area behind the domes. There's not much of the mountaintop that we can see behind us where the Keck domes are.
Oh,
In front of us, there's a little drop and then a flat expanse of red rock and earth.
Okay.
Beyond that, white clouds that hide the island below.
This is beautiful, though. Okay, so peeking out of the clouds over there, what am I looking at?
That's Haleakala over there, just off in the way off in the distance.
That's amazing. And what's the sort of hydraulics sound that I'm hearing?
I think that's coming from Subaru.
Okay.
I guess it's some exhaust fans or something that they've got running. That's the proposed TMT site down there.
So between where we're standing and Haleakala?
Yeah, just that plateau down there. Aren't those colors incredible?
It's stunning. What's amazing to me is that how the way everything does look different from this high up, and the mountain, the other mountains within the clouds kind of look like islands.
Like islands.
Yeah.
Emerging out of a sea below us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this looks like a very different sunset than any sunset I've ever seen before.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of glow along the horizon line. Do you think you could ever get jaded of something like this? Just like, yeah.
I hope not. I hope I never get jaded to this. I hope that I will always be able to at least pause for a moment and go, wow, look at that.
You put on little jackets.
Okay.
But, you know, you don't actually have to do this if you stay outside the yellow lines.
And what are the blue sticky floors for?
Where you try to reduce dirt, because you don't want to get it on the instrument that you're going to send into space, and this is to get the dirt off the bottom of your shoe.
Gotcha.
Ed Stone is the executive director of the 30-meter telescope's governing board. A thin, kind of frail-looking man with white hair and a lot of energy for an 81-year-old. We're in Pasadena at Caltech, where Ed's been a professor for roughly 40 years. He's something of a legend in the astronomy community. He served as head of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory for a while, sat on the board of the Keck Observatory for more than two decades. He comes across as a pretty reserved guy. That is, until we go to the basement of the astronomy building with one of his colleagues, to a lab where the two men are working on building a tiny instrument for measuring solar flares.
You look really happy down here, Ed. Tell me about what you feel when you're down in this room.
Well, this is where you build things that go places nothing's been before. And that's where you have a lot to learn. So that's what makes it exciting, is you have to figure out how to make it work. That's exciting. When you achieve that, that's great. And then when you get there, you find things you didn't expect. That's what it's all about.
The backlash over constructing the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea shouldn't have been a surprise to Ed. He'd been on board the Keck Observatory back in the 90s, when Hawaiian activists successfully fought Keck efforts to expand its telescopes. But there's been plenty of testimony in recent months about the 30-meter telescope and what people should or shouldn't have known, should or shouldn't have tried to do. And I didn't come to Pasadena to try and flesh out permitting details. I want to hear the argument for why the world needs the 30-meter telescope from a man who's been involved in the building efforts since day one.
We would like to see the very first stars in the universe. The universe began with the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. And for about the first 400 million years, there were no stars. There was no light in the universe until about 400 million years after the beginning. You see, the reason there was no starlight was because after the Big Bang, all the matter was diffuse. And to make stars, you have to bring it together, have it clump and compress so it gets very hot, and then nuclear fusion can take place and light comes. But you have to have a lot of mass collected, and it took about 400 million years, we think, before there was enough mass collected together to cause nuclear fusion. And so slowly but surely, stars turned on, galaxies were forming, and that's what we're trying to understand. What was the process? In what order did things happen as stars were forming?
The farther back in time you peer in the universe, the dimmer objects become. So in order to look back at the moment stars first formed, astronomers need a much bigger telescope, Ed says.
We feel that the 30-meter telescope is large enough with modern adaptive optics and modern instruments to be able to get back to that very beginning.
Ed and scientists from half a dozen partner countries involved in building the 30-meter telescope say it's worth $1.4 billion, worth all the effort.
So it's helping us understand our place in this immense universe that surrounds us.
And a telescope that big might be our best bet of answering another big question.
I think for many people, the most exciting thing would be the evidence that there's life elsewhere, because it's such a fundamental issue. How did life begin on Earth? And did it begin anywhere else? Either in the solar system itself, where we believe there are opportunities, or in one of these exoplanets, which are being discovered at an increasing rate.
Beyond that, astronomy contributes to society in unexpected ways. The GPS in your phone, the Wi-Fi in your computer, all use technology originally developed by astronomers to better map the sky. So there is a bit of a competitive aspect to having such a giant telescope in American hands.
It drives the technology in ways that you cannot predict. It's basic research where you're just applying advances in technology to understand nature, but in the process you have to invent new ways of manipulating things, and those new ways often have other ramifications. I think it's to the advantage of the U.S. to have these high technology things as part of their culture, part of their economy. That's what has produced the standard of living which we've all grown to appreciate.
Ed says the 30-meter telescope will build on innovations that started with the Keck observatories. Instead of 36 segmented mirrors, it will have 492. That will make TMT the largest telescope in the world, though not for long. A group of European countries is building a 39-meter telescope in Chile. And people who oppose the 30-meter telescope say that's proof there's no need to build it in Hawaii. Of course, Ed disagrees.
That's because the universe is really immense, and knowing where to look and how long to look, you really do need more than just one telescope to really address these fundamental questions, just because the universe itself is so immense and so complex.
What will be lost if TMT isn't built on Mauna Kea?
It will really be a loss to American leadership, because even though we build it, it will not be built in the U.S. It will be built somewhere else. I think we all like to feel that we're associated with something that's sort of breaking new ground. It's sort of the frontier spirit. And I think that America really does have this attitude of doing things no one else does or can do. And I think that's a very important part of our culture. And it's a very important part of our place in the world.
Could you just tell us, like, where we are?
Yeah, so normally these offices are just simply called base facilities. And on this particular street, I don't know if the people in Hilo realize how unique this street is worldwide.
That's Doug Simons, the executive director of the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope, the oldest international telescope on the mountain.
All but two of the observatories have their base facilities, their sort of home offices here on this street on the University of Hawaii Hilo campus. And you're looking at buildings that have a phenomenal amount of engineering and scientific expertise up and down this particular street that literally is not matched anywhere else in the world.
Every astronomer I've talked to, including Doug, wants to see the 30-meter telescope built, sees it as the next step in mankind's quest to understand the universe. But for astronomers who live in Hawaii, people who've worked for years or decades on Mauna Kea, supporting the telescope has come at a price, one that astronomers on the mainland who aren't connected to the community here don't have to pay.
I literally saw the transformation of my staff from being very proud to be identified as observatory employees to being scared. And I thought that was pathetic. That's ridiculous. We have nothing to be ashamed of. It's not like we just woke up and somehow we're bad people. It was a really difficult time, very, very intimidating for staff who are completely inexperienced with dealing with that kind of social pressure.
Like Doug's friend Jessica Dempsey, deputy director of the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, A few weeks after the big protest began in 2015, a stranger in Hilo asked Jessica what she did for a living.
I paused for the first time before saying that I was an astronomer. And just that pause of going, I'm actually nervous to say what I do. And then it was so interesting because I said, okay, well, I'm an astronomer. And she was this lovely local lady, and she just looked at me with pity, and she said, oh, I'm sorry. And that really was when I had this sort of revelation that, wow, you know, we've really in a different place at the moment, because she felt sorry for me. She was trying to give her sympathy in any way she could that, you know, that, oh, you know, oh, it's a terrible time to be an astronomer in Hilo. I think that was the moment when I realized that, you know, we had some work to do.
So Doug and a few others, they organized a community event during the height of protests against the TMT. Doug was worried the event might end in a fight or that people wouldn't show up. But the results were revelatory, at least for him. The event lasted more than 3 hours. People from the community came, listened to speakers from both sides respectfully, asked questions. And while the people on stage represented very different points of view, it seemed to Doug like everyone was really listening to each other.
It was kind of an epiphany. We all gathered hands at the end. We sang, a lot of tears. I could feel that everybody was so tense going into that. From the conflict, that we all kind of needed to you know, take a collective deep breath.
That collective deep breath, it changed his life.
And I promised myself in the course of that incredible evening to do everything in my power to try and find a lasting solution.
Addressing the conflict over Mauna Kea is now something of a second full-time job for Doug. But when Doug says he wants to find a lasting solution, he's not talking about a solution to the 30-meter telescope. Sure, he'd like to see the telescope built, but the battle over Mauna Kea is about a lot more than one telescope for him.
If TMT just, you know, implodes tomorrow, the conflict is still, the seeds of it are still in place.
And that conflict, it could threaten the future of all astronomy in Hawaii. And with it, some of the best tools for finding answers to big existential questions about the universe.
The other thing that'll happen is a huge loss in confidence in any international funding, which is most of the funding in the Mauna Kea observatories, that there are already questions being raised, particularly if TMT doesn't go forward, about whether or not it's worth the risk to put any significant investment. Forget about new telescopes. We're just talking about sustaining the ones that we have now.
And then there's the issue of the University of Hawaii's master lease for the land on Mauna Kea. The lease is up for renewal in 2033, a date already on the calendar of some of the fiercest opponents of the 30-meter telescope.
The number one producer of new knowledge in the universe is the Mauna Kea observatories, quite literally. So I fully understand the consequences of the observatories not going forward. So we need to find a way to stabilize that situation out and reinstate confidence in the international community that Hawaii is still going to engage astronomy in the 21st century.
This is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. The community event that inspired astronomer Doug Simons to try and seek out a solution to the conflict over Mauna Kea, not everyone walked away from that night with the same warm feelings. Even when astronomers and Native Hawaiians sit down to build bridges, miscommunication abounds. Why are scientists so reluctant to talk about their spirituality? And what will it take for the people opposing TMT to feel they're truly being heard? That's next time on Offshore. You don't want to miss it. Speaking of missing it, this season we're doing things a little differently and posting episodes every other week. So if you're looking for the next episode of Offshore, come back on April 20th. If you're looking for a good podcast to tide you over, or if you need help navigating Trump's America, I highly recommend subscribing to Politically Reactive, a podcast by our sister company, First Look Media. In season 2 of Politically Reactive, comedians and friends, W. Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu examine and explore the U.S. political landscape. The hosts answer questions and separate fact from fake news with support from some of today's most fascinating artists, activists, writers, journalists, and political thinkers. Guests include CNN commentator Angela Rye, former Daily Show correspondent Asif Manvi, and co-founder of Black Lives Matter, Patrice Kunkullers. Join Kamau and Harry as they figure out how to create a more perfect movement and work on staying joyful in the face of the unknown. Subscribe now to Politically Reactive on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Offshore is produced by Honolulu Civil Beat, a member-supported nonprofit news organization dedicated to covering the real Hawaii. Donate to support this podcast and our journalism at civilbeat.org. Offshore is distributed by PRX. Offshore is produced by April Esterlon and me, Jessica Terrell. Our executive producer is Patty Epler. Our editor is Ben Adair. We'll be back in 2 weeks.